Welcome all on the VFX Artist Podcast. And I guess we are an independent podcast by artists, and we generally bring on artists from all types of different VFX departments and to discuss how people are going into in the industry, how they've progressed through their journey, and just discuss all sorts of VFX topics. And today we just thought we'd use our platform to discuss AI, and the rise of AI art, which is has been for the past 6 months, I think, has been quite popular, and quite noticeable, especially on LinkedIn. And we thought we would explore what the impacts or the issues could be for our industry and the creative industry in general. So, so here we are.
Coffee, just to follow that up with you real quick, should we be live on YouTube as well?
We are live on YouTube.
Okay, cool. Because I was just checking it on the side here and I couldn't see it. Okay. Okay,
It
lovely.
should be live. Yeah, so let me just double share my screen. Just sharing the presentation that I made. Yeah, so AI in the VFX and creative industry. We're looking to explore the impacts, solutions, and issues. I'll have to say that this podcast or this webinar is inspired by the Concept Art Association. They did an AI town hall webinar on YouTube, just discussing this same topic. And I think they did a great job just covering the basics of it and the whole topic. So I just thought to give them credit. Today's outline, you just want to go through the impacts and issues and solutions and possibly do a Q&A and just see what people think about it. Maybe I might actually ask Simon, because you might know more about it. So, are you able to maybe tell us a bit more about maybe why we're here, what AI art is, and just the competition that we have on screen, I guess.
So from my point of view, the reason I reached out to you and thought that this would be a good conversation is I found myself talking about AI in broad terms within the company that I work for, Untold. And just before we go any further, I just want to say that all opinions that I speak today are my own and not my company's. I kind of thought like there is a lot of speaking in our industry that needs to be done about this subject because especially with the visual a well, you know, I want to say AI, that's a very broad term, but AI, ML, neural network specifically, and then diffusion as a subset of that. Diffusion in particular has been like something that has hit the visual industry like a truck in the last 4 or 5 months. You know, when Midjourney really came out, it was almost like personally I got a bit of a strange feeling of like what is happening here. After a few days, I realized, okay, it can't do this, it can't do that, we're safe here. But then as I saw the entire industry and the subject progressing and realizing how much like granular control people are getting, you know, every couple of weeks, this is moving very, very fast. And I feel like I can talk to my small network of friends here and there as much as I can, but there's a broad discussion that needs to be had about this because it's going to affect us all. Whether we work in graphic design, concept art, texture painting, modeling, or rendering even. You know, there are diffusion plugins for Blender right now that essentially tries to replace a renderer. Like, it's not killing it, but 4 months ago, Midjourney was not killing it at concept art, but now it is. So I just thought, why not talk about it with as broad of a bunch of people as we can find, and just, you know, I guess in many ways that, you know, over to you guys, because I have my own opinions, potential fears. You know, I also think it's awesome, and you know, you can't ignore progress. That's essentially why, you know, I kind of reached out to you, Coffee. So, yeah. Oh, you're still muted.
Yeah, of course. I was just saying, funny enough, because this is my first time going live, so I just realized I wasn't live. But now we are.
Yeah, because I have like YouTube open.
Yeah, now we're live. Okay. But okay.
Simon, say that all again.
I could say it again in a shorter amount of time. Yeah. When I reached out to you, Coffee, my main concern was that AI was progressing a lot faster than I initially thought it would when Midjourney first reared its head about 4 months ago. 4 months ago, Midjourney was impressive. It did images that were kind of amazing. One of them still my wallpaper on my desktop. But you know, you could tell that like, it wasn't doing anything. It was doing some cool stuff, but a concept artist needed to still be involved to make it make sense. But then in the last 4 or 5 months, you know, the control over what you can do, you literally just paint out a hand and try again until the hand starts, you know, coming through. It's becoming actually useful. It looks like it's becoming useful. And I think there's a broad discussion to be had in VFX, because it's not just going to impact graphic designers, concept artists. It's absolutely going to impact the daily job of texture artists. If you look at, you know, some current push in by NVIDIA, modelers, lighting artists with Blender plugins that are using Diffusion as essentially the render engine, it still seems slightly uncontrollable, but so did Midjourney 4 months ago. And we're only talking about a 4 months gap from Midjourney to being able to use Dream Studio now, where you can put your own head as an anime character on, you know, on a prompt, on a beautiful picture that you just created with a prompt. So I think all of us in the visual media and VFX industry should be keeping a very close eye on this, and more importantly, probably just talk about it instead of just keeping it to ourselves, keeping our anxieties or you know, hopes to ourselves. I think it's good to just put it out there and talk about it and learn from each other.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if you don't mind, just because I forgot to ask you to introduce yourself, can you tell us about yourself and what your role is, if that's okay?
I'm a real-time supervisor at Untold Studios in London. Initially, my job was to mainly take care of Unreal and real-time elements, but I kind of found myself sliding into AI when it came out. And lately, I've sort of been the point of contact for AI as well at Untold. A good thing to mention, as I mentioned that as well, is all these opinions that I will speak today are my own. You know, I'm not speaking for Untold. That's what I do. That's who I am.
Okay, great. All right, I'm just gonna represent my slide just for everyone that missed out. So let's see. Okay. All right. So for everyone that's just tuned in, welcome to the AI in the VFX creative industry webinar. We're just trying to discuss the impacts and issues and possibly find the solutions to how AI art could maybe influence or help our industry. This webinar is inspired by the Concept Art Association, which previously did an AI town hall about a month ago, discussing the same topic. And I found that topic very interesting and very insightful. So I gathered some inspiration from it. Yeah, so as I said, we're going to touch on the impacts and the issues and solutions and possibly take some questions from the crowd. We'll be hopefully touching base on these three companies, of which Midjourney is on the left, and DALL-E, and Stable Diffusion, the three maybe top companies currently. So just trying to explain what AI art is basically how these platform works is you give the AI a prompt. So you tell it, you give it a set of keywords and or a sentence and give it a prompt, and you ask it to generate an art piece. So this is a comparison between the results generated by Midjourney and DALL-E and Stable Diffusion using the same prompts, which is looking at behind the scenes of shooting the moon landing, Hollywood Studio 1969, backstage photograph, astronaut, actors and lighting. So all these three platforms gave us three different results using the same prompt. And as you can tell, you can literally create any image from the prompts that you give it. But just today we're just going to try and work out where the copyrights, where the data sets is being gathered, and who owns the rights and all of that stuff. So that's what we're going to touch base on. This image on the left is an image that I tried to make on Midjourney, because I was looking to make an image for this webinar. So I went in and gave it a prompt of a photograph of an advanced technology humanoid with a female head, long hair, pretty in a dress, but with mechanical arms, holding a painting brush in left hand and painting a palette in the other hand, standing in front of a cool deception. But this is what I generated. And then on the right is what Carlo in the guest made and sent me. And I just, comparing the two, I felt his felt stronger as an image and as a concept and as a final render. So I chose his over what I created using Midjourney. So that's something to think about. So yeah, just let's discuss how it will all impact us, and let's see how it goes. So yeah, Simon, it'd be great to hear how you came across AI art, because the past 6 months, I think I discovered it from you on LinkedIn, and it was a buzz for some time and everyone wanted to trial it. And just let us know how you've been using it and what you've been finding about it and your thoughts about it. It'd be great.
Sure. I think maybe before I start rambling on about myself too much, would it be a good idea to have everybody introduce themselves?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I'm just going to go with what I see, the order that I see. So Vlad, you're the first person I see.
Hi guys, I work in the VFX industry, I live in the UK. I've worked for a lot of companies as a modeler and texture artist. I'm a sculptor as well. I sculpt, also a character artist. So, and as I said before, I've never used AI. I haven't generated a single image. So I'm really, I know how it is done in theory, but then in practice, I don't have the life experience when it comes to AI. But I've got a lot of questions. I've got a lot of questions.
You're the very definition of VFX artist. it's great to have you here. Excellent. Carlo, you're the next one on my list.
Yep. Hello, I'm Carlo. I'm a 3D artist, Blender artist. And I live in, I'm in a digital nomad, but I'm in Valencia at the moment. Been here for quite a while, so not much nomad.
Lucky you.
It's a nice place to be. I got stuck here during lockdown, haven't moved. So, and I come from not from a VFX background. I come from an engineering background, and I create mainly B2B sort of content. A lot of my work is that, not all of it. So, that's the sort of angle that I'm looking at. Whether marketing agencies will be able to do the stuff that I do for them on their own with this kind of technology. And a bit like Vlad, I've not got much. I've used Midjourney a little bit, and I sort of delved into it, and I saw the big sort of rise of it and wanted to get involved, but I haven't. I got bored of it, really. I did a bit of dabbling and then.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to talk about when it comes to B2B, for sure. Tom, you're the next little image on my screen.
I'm Tom Payton. I'm a writer, director, producer, and founder of a new company called Pigeon Shrine, which is based out of the West Midlands. And I'm a massive AI fanboy. I suspect I might end up being the bad guy on this particular chat, because a lot of what I'm doing is about completely rejigging the production pipeline, you know. And I think that the advantage that I've got as a fresh faced company is, you know, I'm coming off the back of 9 movies, but without a pipeline of product that needs to be finished. So I don't have a backlog of clients at a higher end whose work is already in an existing workflow. So we're essentially rebuilding the entire production pipeline from the ground up using AI assistance at pretty much every level, including concept art, VFX work, sound mixing, post-production, you know, really kind of integrating all those elements. And you know, there's a real push for me to be able to bring production costs down and push the final product's quality up, and then in turn, perhaps change some of the culture around the way VFX artists are treated within the film world, period. So, yeah, that's me.
full disclosure there, Tom, I think we're getting a little bit of a cut video. We can hear most of what you're saying, but sometimes it goes a little bit.
Sure. I'll swap my internet.
Cool. If you can do that, then yeah, that might work.
Sure.
I guess in the meantime, Jamie, do you want to jump on then?
Yeah, sure.
Say hi.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jamie Bakewell, and I've been in the film industry since 2009, working as an artist, as a previs visualization artist on films like Jurassic World, James Bond, and Guardians of the Galaxy, and plenty of other big movies. And I set up my own previs company based in the West Midlands in 2018. We're now a West Midlands based visualization company, also working on Netflix movies and commercials and video game cinematics for big titles.
Well, don't forget the plug. What's the name of the company?
Thank you, Simon. Company called Big Tooth Studios, based in the West Midlands. And not really delve too much into AI, but just started using, you know, Midjourney, just like Discord generator, just having a little play in spare times. But a few of our artists on our team are obsessed with generating artwork of themselves as superheroes and all sorts of really, really cool stuff. And yeah, me and Tom, we, as of like a few months ago, we've been sending back and forth, yeah, lots of AI stuff and articles and videos and links and all that cool stuff. So it's very exciting and scary and curious and all sorts of feelings. But yeah, here we are. And
it's great, the same for all of us. Yeah. Welcome back, Tom. Sorry.
Yeah, I fix it now. Is that better? I think that works, right?
Perfect.
Yeah, perfect. There you go.
Excellent. So yeah, thanks Tom again, and Jamie, thank you. That's a previs, actually, I think we can talk about as well. We can talk about it later, but you know, AI for animation is happening as we speak, quite properly. Anthony, you're the next beautiful icon on my page.
Gosh, well, you're charming me, Simon. I'm Anthony Martin. I work at Staffordshire University. I'm a course leader and senior lecturer for concept art. We have a concept art course up at Staffordshire University with quite a lot of students. And I've been very interested in watching AI seemingly explode almost out of nowhere after over the last 4-5 months or so. And I've been watching it with interest. I'm fairly skeptical of it, but I'm also excited about some of the applications of it that don't necessarily affect concept artists. I used to also do VFX and animation before I started teaching at university. I actually am not quite as convinced that AI imagery, and I'd like to call it AI imagery rather than AI art at the moment, I'm less convinced that it will necessarily replace concept artists as such. I think it will pose a big threat to illustrators, and that saddens me to a certain extent, but I'm very interested in how it can be integrated into the nuts and bolts of VFX work, like you mentioned earlier, about how it can almost form a substitute renderer and deal with compositing issues and tasks and texture generation. The techie part of me finds that more interesting maybe than the actual generating kind of what to me looks like very cliched kind of artwork. But I'm sure we'll get into that a bit later.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we will. Actually, I will take a quick note after you've said that. I will need to talk about this. excellent. And Justin, well, I know you because we work together at Untold, but introduce yourself for the other people.
That's right. Thank you so much. I'm Justin Brown. I'm working as an effects artist at Untold Studios. And I'm mostly, I would say I'm a generalist working mostly on commercials and TV shows in the past. And before that, I was working on like as a compositor and a little bit as a DOP. Quickly transitioned into like 3D, and that's my main focus right now. And I'm in the lucky position at Untold to do a little bit with machine learning as well. I'm integrating Stable Diffusion into Nuuk. We are doing like a lot of progress there. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm super happy to be here. Yeah.
If I can add something to your introduction.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to say that Justin has been on top of machine learning progress since at least 2018, maybe 2017 when I first met him. And he actually used some earlier machine learning techniques to make an amazing short film where he actually used machine learning to mix and match and create mega scans out of mega scans. I don't quite understand how that all works, but Justin has been actually using machine learning hands-on for quite a long time. So as humble as he seems right now, he actually he's deep into it.
Thank you.
Cool. And then I guess Coffee, you were just asking me to introduce myself. So yeah, I'm the real-time soup at Untold, and the way that I got into machine learning was initially out of interest, talking to Justin years ago, looking at, I started a motion capture studio a few years ago called the MoCap Studio in London. And very creative name, I know. And it's good for Google hits. And while we had this motion capture studio, one of our main gripes, I guess, one of our main issues was motion capture cleanup. And motion capture cleanup traditionally has just been a manual job. You know, you bring mocap into Motion Builder or Maya, and, you know, back then, KinFX, Houdini didn't exist, or Houdini existed, but KinFX didn't. So, you know, I was very interested in seeing how machine learning could help that. And back then there was already quite a few efforts and a few startups that were even asking us, like emailing us as a motion capture company, asking for data, just saying, can you just send us data, like animation, mocap data, like anything you've got, can you send it to us? And, you know, back then we were like, we're trying to run a business. So we're like, okay. And what do we get in return? And they're like, you can get like a 1 month trial to our, you know, new amazing motion, AI motion capture cleanup solver. So at the time we said thanks, but no thanks, because these companies we had no connection with, we didn't understand what they were doing. But I was interested. I was like, okay, let's see what that really means. And it turns out that, you know, a long time before Disco Diffusion came out and Diffusion in general came out, machine learning was already doing pretty well with simple data. So simple data is parameters and numbers, basically a spreadsheet. You know, machine learning, like writing some machine learning to manage a spreadsheet, is actually pretty easy, dare I say, because there's not a lot of numbers to play with. And motion capture is the same. You've only got a certain amount of bones. All these bones have got a rotation value and a translation value over a bunch of frames. It's basically just a big spreadsheet. And so at the time, it felt like somehow it was within my reach to actually do some of that myself. There were a few tutorials out there, a bunch of GitHubs. And I started kind of like getting deeper into like, well, can I actually write some training to clean up the motion capture that we generate? And then I met Justin, who kind of started telling me about how much harder it was than I thought it was. So at that point, you know, I didn't really personally push the machine learning for motion capture cleanup much further. I just kind of moved on to running my business. But it wasn't until Midjourney reared its head that I had almost forgotten about machine learning at that point. You know, I was like, yeah, it's cool. It seems really hard to get anything done. Then Midjourney came out, and just the and the open models like Disco Diffusion, or the Lion 5B model that Disco Diffusion was based on, started coming out. And then it's almost like about 4 or 5 months ago, there's like somebody lit a match and just set fire to this whole business or industry with progress just happening at breakneck speed. So now I'm just running with everybody else, just trying to keep up to date with all the progress that's happening. I'm on all the subreddits, I'm on all the Discord channels, and still like the information is just overwhelming. It's very hard to keep up with.
Yeah, sure. So are you able to tell us a bit about your integration into your pipeline and how you use it? And yeah, maybe what you worry about.
I'll jump in very quickly about how I've used it. And then I'll let Justin talk about how we're looking at integrating it into our pipeline. How I've used it was for, there's a WWF, not the wrestling, but the World Wildlife Foundation, commercial, which will come out in, I think, 2 days from now. And that was a director who is famous for using cutting edge technology in strange ways. So a few years ago, he did a short film or a commercial that used depth sensors to create very kind of interesting shapes and form and stuff. And so that director is very in tune with emerging tech, and really enjoys using emerging tech to do his work. And he approached us to do this WWF TV commercial. And at some point, I made the mistake of going like, oh, maybe we could do this with AI. And he was like, AI, I like that. Let's talk more. Disco Diffusion was kind of a thing at that point. Disco Diffusion Warp. So there was a Disco Diffusion Warp, which is a fork of Disco Diffusion that used optical flow to deform the Disco Diffusion stuff. So make it animated, like an easy way to make it animate without like just flickering. So we just started using that, and it was a weird 3 or 4 weeks of just generating random stuff by typing prompts, mm-hmm. like fire, death, fish dying, skulls, like just mm-hmm. words, and we had supervisors jumping in going like, type this sentence in and let's see what this does. And it was like a very strange workflow, because as VFX artists, we're used to controlling every single pixel that we make and massaging it into place and doing. And this one was more like, here's a whole bunch of stuff. Let's see what we can do with it. And luckily we had really talented compers to turn my absolute insanity output into something cohesive. So that's when we used it first as a studio. Justin is actually the one taking the torch in terms of implementing it in a serious way, not in a like hacker in the bedroom kind of way.
Still doing that though.
So yeah, Justin, like, you can probably like talk about the Nuke stuff that we're doing at the moment, or
sure. In general, I think like the opportunities for AI are quite broad, I would say, already with like the existing setups. I think there are a lot of different departments that can benefit from them. So basically, what we're right now doing is integrating it mostly into Nuke, but we have like a system that can, we are running all the stuff locally. I've seen like a lot of plugins already out there for Photoshop, for example, that communicate with a server running somewhere on the internet, basically. And we are actually using like our internal hardware and running an internal server, which right now is just like running on the machine the users using, and it's connecting with different softwares. So for example, right now it's just Nuke and Houdini, which can talk to this Stable Diffusion server, and it's accepting prompts. You can, for example, load an image in, select an area, and type something you want to change, and it generates it quite quickly on the fly, loads it back in, and we're trying to make it as seamless as possible to really iterate fast, iterate quickly with like input images, or like you draw something in Nuke quickly with the paint node, and you feed that into the server, and it generates something that you can use. So that's the idea behind it. But we got really good feedback from the compositing team. We're just trying to roll it out and giving like people the opportunity to test it, and collecting feedback for that. So that's roughly at the stage where we are. I mean, plans for getting different departments into the Stable Diffusion thing as well. We have some progress on the texture generation part. For example, in Houdini, you can use the server to generate some textures for objects you have. What we're gonna do is implementing something that's similar to the Blender rendering tool for Houdini. So we have something that works for our pipeline, because we don't really use Blender that much.
I was curious about Tom mentioned that you were also a writer and director. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So my background is in production. I've produced, directed, written most of them, and delivered to international buyers 9 movies at this stage.
And so the reason I was really curious to hear about what you had to say is I have a friend who's a director, and you know, when Midjourney came out, I sent him an invite, and he just went crazy. Just all of a sudden said, like, I can make the posters, I can make the all the pitch decks that I wanted to make, that I always had to kind of call upon a friend or a favor or somebody to kind of help me out to visualize what I'm trying to say here. He's just been so happy because he's just been able to like just generate these pitch decks just all on his own. How do you feel about it? Is that something you've been doing as well?
My a little bit like Justin, really. You know, I've been kind of on the AI tip for a very long time. I watched a short film called Sunspring, which was written by an AI back in 2016. They got Thomas Middleditch to come and star in it. And, you know, it was kind of like this bizarre Shakespearean. It didn't make any sense, but it was kind of entertaining. And, you know, at the time it was kind of this jokey product that everyone was like, haha, look at the silly AI short film. But I remember thinking back then, okay, this is the future for all departments. And so I've kind of made it a sort of a vested, part of my journey to stay on top of integrating AI as, you know, whenever we could, really. And it hit the sound world first. You know, it became super quick and easy for us to use in terms of sound cleanup and bringing those costs down. You know, we've started using it within composing and music departments, and I'm working with my composer to speed up turnaround times using AI. Just recently we did, we filled in ADR on a movie that we just delivered that flew through QC, And we never actually got the actors back. We just trained the voice models to replicate them. And then I essentially did the performances, filled in the gaps, and, you know, we flew through. And the thing with AI is it kind of lets you do this in all kind of departments. And I think, you know, with the visual element stuff, you know, Midjourney especially, a lot of filmmakers are finding the problem when you're trying to get something off the ground, right? Like, and to, before a product ever gets to you guys where there's a locked budget, you know, and we can say, oh, well, this is how much we've got to spend on this. There's years of front-loaded work where you start with, most of the time, indie filmmakers start with absolute zero, you know, and they're just trying to be their own hype machine and convince people that they should put some development funds in. And then that development fund gets spent on people like Vlad and Carlo, you know, but then you're already like 9-10 months into a process by that point, and most of these producers and directors are now eating pot noodles and starving to death and end up quitting and the project never gets going. And all of a sudden, Midjourney empowers them to be able to put that out there. One of the interesting things we've done this year is, you know, I've got 3 projects that are all about to go. They're all now funded. They're all ready to go. And nearly all of them attach their cast by generating images of that actor inside the character. And then sending it to them directly. You know, like there was one guy, I won't say any names, but, you know, I'm on a Zoom with this quite famous actor trying to talk him into it. And while I'm talking to him, I'm generating stuff on Stable Diffusion, like down here in my lap. And then I'm sending him, like, oh, check this out. And I'm certain that's what made him join the project, and we're funded for that. So, you know, this stuff is really powerful just in terms of getting your project off the ground in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad, because there's a lot to unpack there. I guess number one, you know, like you did mention at the beginning, and look, we all understand here that like starting your own film or your own project, your own production, you know, there's no money there. It's just blood, sweat, and tears, and belief in yourself. Like there's absolutely no doubt about it, unless you got really rich parents.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where, you know, initially, yeah, back a while back, you would have had to go to Vlad. Now I imagine that Vlad is just fine. And yeah. You know, he's got plenty of work.
Not sure about the future.
But we have to remember that there are younger people, juniors, that may have been happy to also put blood, sweat, and tears into doing the concept art for your film, and may not have that in. So
no, I think it's about repurposing.
And you know,
yeah, I think it's about repurposing. Like, you know, that's part of what we're trying to address is that, you know, I know better than anybody. I never even went to university to study filmmaking. I started my production company when I was 20, probably like 15, 16 years ago now, and just hustled it into existence. And I never want to kind of cheat anybody out of work. And I guess it's about how you repurpose people. So, you know, a big thing me and Jamie have been discussing is the potential for using AI in animation. And, you know, where I would now come to Vlad, where I would have used him in that sort of initial stage to sell the project. Now what I would do with a concept artist like Vlad is, you know, I might use Stable Diffusion to actually fund the project. And then I will bring it to Jamie with that development funds and we'll grayscale out the entire film. And if it's animated, I'll then hire Vlad to come and essentially concept art the first frame of every shot and then feed it back into a, you know, an AI model, you know, like something more advanced, but along the lines of EB Synth, and essentially take his concept art and create AI assisted animation where the delivery times on them are tiny. And actually that lets us go, well, now I pay Vlad more. One of the big things that me and Jamie have been discussing that I'm insistent on, that I think AI will let us do, is start to treat VFX artists like above the line talent, where we're going, actually, people show up to see these products and buy them for your work just as much as the cast name. And the fact that VFX artists are normally right at the back end of the production, after we've messed it all up and the shoot didn't go the way it was supposed to. And then we're relying on the VFX artists to essentially come in and patch it up. But with the smallest amount of money, AI lets us change that workflow and essentially go, well, now we can put more funds into the VFX team themselves and treat them, you know, like we would above the line talent. So that's kind of what we're trying to do with it.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I get it. Like, you know, Vlad doesn't have to, and sorry, Vlad, that we're using you as an example in this. But let's say young Vlad doesn't have to work for you for free in the first couple of years to get the project off the ground, and AI can do that. And then you can pay current Vlad his actual wage to do proper work on the film. That makes a lot of sense. It's actually a really good angle to it.
Yeah. And at faster speeds as well. That's the thing.
Sorry, yeah. How do you feel about that, Vlad, since we've mentioned you so much?
Just on a side note, I'm a 3D artist, but that doesn't change Tom's point, actually.
Yeah.
It goes for everybody. Yeah. I mean, as Tom said, it's all about repurposing.
Yeah.
I know I'm not going to be able to stop it. That's it. It's like a snowball. That's it. It's unstoppable. So we'll have to just adapt. That's the thing.
Yeah. But to go to maybe to Anthony, who's teaching young concept artists who are just kind of starting out in the industry, I guess I'm old enough now that I'm probably not quite 100% in touch with what it means to be young and starting out today. So maybe Anthony can like enlighten us on that front, because as you know, as we just kind of highlighted with Tom, is that, you know, maybe entry jobs might be potentially more scarce, or I don't know. Anthony, if
I think that it's already difficult for young people to get a foot in the door as a concept artist. I think concept art in particular, there's a lot of competition anyway in the VFX art kind of world and games art kind of world. But then with concept art, I think the competition is even greater, because there are just inherently less concept artists working on a game or a film than there are 3D artists or compositors or lighters. And so I think that some of them are very excited and they're wowed by it. They're wowed by the possibilities of it. And they want to explore it. They want to see kind of what can it generate. I think that almost in that sort of pure, joyous, young way of wanting to see, wow, I'm in the future and it feels like a science fiction novel. What can this stuff generate? But then there are others who are legitimately worried, because they think, what is the point of learning to draw, learning to use something like Photoshop or Blender or whatever, learning to develop an eye for art direction when a client, whether they might be the actual producer, director of the game, or an art director, production designer of a film, can just go, well, I don't really need you anymore to do this part of the job. And so they were a bit scared of that. Sorry, Simon, were you going to say something?
I think we lost you for about 10 seconds.
Oh, no. So I'm not sure where I got. So there are students who are excited about it. And they're probably at the moment in the minority, but they are genuinely excited about it, because they see it as an exciting thing. You know, they feel like they're living in the future. But then there are others who are genuinely fearful of it, because they think that what is the point of me doing 3 or 4 years worth of university education to learn how to draw, to learn how to paint, to learn how to design, when a client, it doesn't matter if it's in the games or the film or the TV industry, can just come up with a particularly good prompt and get what they want. I try and reassure them. I think that, as I mentioned earlier when I introduced myself, I think for an illustrator, it is generally a really scary time, because illustrators, they're operating on a scary kind of level of generally freelance kind of level, and they have very short deadlines, and their work is often not massively appreciated, or they're given the credit. So I remember seeing that there was during the Alex Jones trial, when he was being taken to court and sued, I think it was the New Yorker or the Atlantic, had a fairly high profile AI generated illustration topping their kind of their article, and it looked perfectly good. It was fine, you know, it worked, and I think a lot of illustrators probably looked at that and were thinking, oh my god, you know, this is it. I can see the writing on the wall. I think the nitty gritty of concept art is a bit different, because concept artists will do illustration kind of work, but that's not really necessarily the actual majority of what they do, especially in a games company. They will have to work with layout artists and level designers and make sure their designs make coherent sense in 3D and are consistent. And I think at the moment, AI has a little bit of trouble doing that. I think one of the telltale signs sometimes of AI art is it can look really cool, it can look really amazing, but there's a certain sloppy messiness to it sometimes that makes you think, what if I asked for that exact same scene but from 90 degrees and then 180 degrees, how rock solid could it make that? And I'm sure, though, it probably will do eventually. I think that this is something that is inevitable now, that, yeah, someone, I think maybe, I can't remember who mentioned it, it is like the cat's out of the bag, you know, it's happening whether we like it or not. When it comes to teaching students, if they ask to use AI art in their assignments, then I'm okay with them doing that, as long as they're clear and open that they're using it. And to be honest, I don't think at the moment a student could really hide that they'd used AI art, because it would be a bit like, here's my drawings here, and they're really sloppy and terrible, and, you know, the perspective's awful, but then, oh look, here's my final product, and it's this perfect rendered amazing prize winning kind of image. I don't think they could get away with that. I'm kind of all over the place in terms of, I'm very impressed with the technology of it, but I really don't like the business model of these companies. I think they're very sketchy, some of them.
Yeah, that's something we could move on to, unless anybody else wants to jump in after Anthony to add anything to it.
Like for me, I'm kind of new-ish to it, so I haven't really dived into it too much to really know too much about it. But I guess from a previous side of things, it's quite interesting, because you know, like Tom said about sort of, you know, because previs, there's all sorts of levels of previs. It sort of can be grayscale, it can be high-end previs. The client wants super high quality, or they want just like grayscale cubes, but they want to see something, but it's not final, but it kind of is there to, you know, paint a picture and tell a story. I can see it, you know, benefiting the sort of speed, because we're going back and forth with changes and, you know, tweak this, change that. What's it look like, you know, over here? And when Tom said about sort of grayscaling the whole scene, and then being able to just paint a concept frame and then generate that through the whole thing, I mean, that's time saving. We're all about saving time and being efficient. Not that efficient is always good, but it's very interesting. So I'm kind of just here to observe, ask questions, and just find out more. And if there's any questions about previs and how we can see it, you know, in the future, then I'll happily answer it from a visualization perspective. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to chip in though about if I could just chip in about the actual. I think the thing is, concept artists, especially like students that are learning now, they shouldn't, in my opinion, right? Like, it's one thing being able to type in, oh, a wizard with a hat on, right, and generate that image. But actually, you know, the art of prompt creation is in itself rooted in an artist's knowledge. You know, like, the more detailed a prompt becomes, you can always tell when somebody, you know, who is a very talented artist with a deep knowledge and respect for where they learn their art from. You can always tell when that person uses AI. Their prompts are so complex, they're so informed, that all of a sudden there's nothing ropey about that AI image. And then when you give it to somebody who doesn't have that artistic background and they just type wizard with a hat on, you know, that's when you get that traditional sort of AI look. And, you know, I kind of feel like there'll always be value in that knowledge that, you know, student artists possess, you know, even if it's a, you know, you're still paying them that traditional day rate, but they're generating you thousands of versions of what you need using their knowledge base to produce that for you. But I'd still pay them for that skill set because it's one that nobody else on the team possesses. And I think that that's something to take into account. I don't see AI art coming along and stealing that bottom layer from people starting out. I think it kind of gives them that window to apply the knowledge that they've learned in a much broader way that gives the client more choice.
Yeah, that knowledge, without getting the amazing image, the knowledge needs to be there to get to that point. Yeah.
Just a question.
So obvious. Yeah. The comparison of someone without the knowledge and then someone with the experience and knowledge of you know, film composition, what looks good, what looks bad, to generate a really good image.
Yeah. Vlad, you were...
Sorry.
Just a question. Are the new young students, concept artists and artists in general, have the drive and inspiration just to study hours and hours of, like, a composition, drawing, just to get to that point, to use this just to generate images by typing words? Are they going to have that inspiration, that drive? That's the question.
I don't think many of them will.
Yeah, I'd like
they
to
won't see that
here
as an appealing future for themselves. I think that it's interesting when you talked about the complexity of prompts, and I've been looking at a lot of the prompts that generate some of the more impressive kind of images, and they're using knowledges of lenses. So they'll often be describing the specific f-stop of that they want for an image. It's almost like the language of a cinematographer or a director, rather than, I think, a traditional artist who will think about depth of field, but they won't be thinking about it in the way that a photographer or a cinematographer or a director kind of thinks about it. So I actually see it as being something that directors and cinematographers, maybe storyboarders, will... that they'll take to it very well. I think that the younger artists who are learning that traditional historical visual art kind of method, where they learn about value and composition in a way that they don't necessarily describe in a verbose way. They're artists. They feel it. You can describe a certain amount to them, but then a big part of it comes from their repetition of actually practically doing this kind of art, and so they begin to feel it. So I think that I don't think many of my students would think I want to do this course so that I would be a really good AI prompt kind of person. I almost feel that's something that a film course, it feels more of a film kind of thing rather than a concept art kind of thing.
But I guess there's always the argument of kind of like, you know, you can deploy image to image. You know, it's like, let's say, you know, Carlo does me an initial design and I go, wow, I love it. You know, I need an entire pitch deck of this. You know, he can essentially train his local model on his particular style or on that particular image and generate the rest of them out the back of it. And it's kind of like trying to find out how we marry the two.
I find that aspect of it, the way you can feed your own stuff into it and get variations far more interesting than trying to just get a pretty picture or just a cool image out of a good prompt. I find it way more interesting, yeah, to think,
yeah,
what
I
can
I
do with my
you.
Own stuff if I want to put in all my own stuff to get a new idea that would feel like me.
I think that kind of opens up the door to talking about all of the artists that are currently in all of the diffusion models that we use who have never agreed on being used in those diffusion models.
Exactly, yeah.
So there is definitely a very, very big question to be asked there.
I think that, you know, it's an opt-out process at the moment. And it should be an opt-in process. And I think even when you opt out, you will be opting out of future data sets.
And when
you will probably still
out,
be in the ones that are still out there at the moment.
What do you opt out of, though? The real question is, as a concept artist right now, a lot of my friends are. I have some work on ArtStation myself, actually. Not a lot, but some. You don't opt out. Because the reality is Midjourney right now, the current model that it uses, if you mention a specific ArtStation artist by name, you will get a style that is reminiscent of that particular artist name.
Mm-hmm.
That means that Midjourney has had to scrape ArtStation. That is against the terms of services of ArtStation.
Yeah, I was looking into this. So, I can't speak. I don't know the data set that Midjourney uses, but I know that the Lion data sets, if you read their FAQ about copyright infringement and how they kind of scrape these images, they make fairly clear that they're not actually scraping the image themselves. They're scraping a URL that points to the image. And they...
An NFT.
Yeah, they're a lot like that. Yeah, and I reading the FAQ, it there's a certain amount of mealy mouthedness to their description about how they try and reassure you, I suppose, that it's okay. You know, it's not really, it's not like we're stealing their art, but at the same time, our system just points to the location on the internet where that art is. You know, it never downloads it. That kind of aspect to it, I think I don't really like. It feels like it brings me up to the other point of there's dance diffusion, isn't there? I think it's that they're doing a dance music version of AI generated art, and they're very clear with music, very clear that they will only use Creative Commons copyright free music or music that's specially commissioned, because they know that music publishers will definitely come down on them like a ton of bricks. But
they already have, actually. Yeah. I read an article recently that they already have lawyers geared up to fight for them. The thing is the music industry has a representative body can and will fight for them.
Yeah.
Visual artists don't.
They don't. And you can totally see why that is. I mean, the music industry comes from big major publishers where licensing and royalties and the legal framework is all there, and artists work for record labels that then get published. Whereas visual artists tend to just work for themselves. They might be either hobbyists or they might be freelancers. There is no massive union that can support them. So it of course, you know, there's no incentive really for these kind of AI companies to sort of proactively go, yeah, let's make it opt-in. Even though I think that's silly in a way, because I think there would be many visual artists who would love to opt-in, who would be very happy to contribute to it. But of course, there wouldn't be 2 billion artists to do that.
Everything would look like anime.
Yeah, well, that's another thing, isn't it? It's I think I it wasn't me, but I read someone who they wondered if they could break AI art by just typing AI. into Midjourney. What happens when you type AI into Midjourney? And the four different images that they got were basically the same white, sexy, pretty woman who looked vaguely cyborg, but with vaguely Asian kind of figures. So you know that this, it's like input output. It's being steered towards a certain demographic. I think one of the examples Kofi had in his slideshow was old man. Now, nowhere in the description did it say white old man, but all the three images were white old men kind of coming out of it. So I think that there's these things are being steered towards a certain way as well. They're being aesthetically judged. The data sets are being aesthetically judged.
I mean, let's all be thankful that all of these AIs didn't scrape 4chan.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they had.
Yeah, they probably did.
I mean, they are non-curated, I think. So it's basically big collection of everything. And I mean, this is maybe something that's capturing this kind of thing as well. And I'm just wondering, what I wanted to ask you is, do you think, would you treat like the AIs as like something, just like a compression algorithm, taking all those 4 billion pictures and interpolating between them? Or are you more like, because no one is, if you're opening your browser and going to ArtStation, you can look at any image as a concept artist and use it as reference. Would you treat it the same? Or I'm interested in your mind, does it feel like the same, or is it more more as an interpolation between existing stuff? Because as a concept artist or as a director, you have your own feelings, your own real world anchored experience that you try to get into your art. You have like an intention that's going into the art.
Well, there's no intent, is there, at all happening with AI at all? And I think you're right. It in some ways it is a lot like the front page of ArtStation in a way, which I think is ironic and sort of not surprising in a way. Is that it's scraping lots and lots of stuff, so it's smearing out, and you're getting a kind of an averaging view of what is popular, what people are generating. A lot of. So, and when I look at ArtStation's front page, I see technically really well done kind of art, but I do see a lot of exactly the same kind of stuff. People are into anime. People are into sort of what I would call it cheesecake kind of imagery, that sort of generic attractiveness of characters, a sort of generic view of science fiction environments where all the futuristic cities, even when generated by real people, they tend to look roughly the same.
That takes the discussion more in a way towards social media and what gets clicks. But I think that's a really pointed way to take it, because in theory, we could actually think of AI and prompts as being the next social media in a way of, like, instead of getting clicks and likes, you're getting a lot of prompts that are requesting your style, or a lot of ads are being kind of generated. And in art, you know, when we look at past art, when we were all disconnected, when there was no real connection between us as humans, African art had its own style and look and definition. You know, obviously, you know, the Egyptian art is still famous to this day for its very kind of particular look and style. The Renaissance brought a whole bunch of new stuff. And back then, we weren't clicking like. We weren't, you know, it wasn't a whole bunch of humans going like, oh, I want to get more of this, I want to get more of that. It was just people doing something, you know, with some very limited information of what could appeal to the people immediately around them. Social media kind of helped popularize a particular type of art, which I 100% agree with you, Anthony, has been, you know, if you just go on ArtStation, you'll see what that art style is. And that's basically the representation of the people clicking like in the world right now who have access to computers and like video games and anime characters. Mm. You know, like it's a very small subset of Earth right now. It relatively small subset of Earth. We think it's the entire world. It really isn't. But we're seeing these, and you know, I hate to use the word, but it is just the right word, like these kind of ancestral development of art, of artist inspiring artist inspiring artist, mm. looking for clicks rather than looking for just art for the sake of it.
I don't judge that kind of art in a way. It might sound like I did in the way that I came across, but I think styles and fashions and what people are into changes, and even before social media, everyone in Europe and America probably were watching similar kind of Hollywood movies, watching the same kind of cartoons, and still liking superhero movies and superhero comics back then as well. So they probably all like that kind of stuff, and I don't think there's anything inherently bad about that. I find it interesting that AI art sort of super spreads that out, because it's taking something that's already a very mainstream tastes and flavors of what art is, and it's spreading that even more. I would like it if it went the other way, and I would almost want the AI to dream itself and to see what does the AI think of when there is no human kind of prompt. I remember before Midjourney came along, well, came along in front of my kind of my eyes, there was an app on my phone called Wombo, I think it was called, and I think it's changed name a couple of times now. And you could basically,
I still got a couple of GIFs from that. That was,
yeah, and really you could fun. Give it basically a prompt, and then you could give it an art style, like a fairly generic art style, like Christmas or cyberpunk or something like that. And I think it was almost trippier and weirder and more interesting, because it was the technology was almost more primitive, and it wasn't as good at understanding the prompt, and so the results you got looked more like a weird otherworldly kind of dream. But I think when you get something like Stable Diffusion, which is technically incredible and now can generate stuff that genuinely looks like the real photo, it almost then becomes, to me, from a purely aesthetic artistic kind of point of view, less interesting, because it's replicating photography now almost, and it's cheaper and it's more convenient, and I can see the appeal of it. You know, I kind of want to see that the smaller, quirkier stuff. I'm more interested in that, I suppose, from a personal point.
I just want to jump in though, because there was
intelligent.
Yeah, sorry. There was a thing about how AI, you know, AI art hasn't got intent. And I feel that's kind of discounting what I can see on, you know, especially in the, you know, the year of R&D that we've been doing. You know, there's actually sort of this emerging kind of, it's like using a new tool. It's like saying, you know, when artists started to use Photoshop and started to create digital art, that, you know, well, this is a tool that's, you know, it's not real art because it's digital. And it's like, I feel like actually, you know, when you're using artificial intelligence in all sorts of ways, you know, artistically speaking, you know, and I'm talking directly as a filmmaker here. And earlier we spoke about, you know, using my knowledge of lenses and light flares and composition, you know, and then coupling that with AI artwork to create something that often feels like it came directly out of my head. Now, you can always say, well, that, you know, where are those images coming from? I think all of us as artists are influenced by the imagery that, you know, art is definitely imitating life and life is imitating art at this stage. And I don't think any of us know where that line is anymore, you know, and I kind of feel like what AI is able to do, if used correctly, is create, it's a tool for a new style of artist to generate, you know, a kind of a new way of getting across their world point of view that existed in a way that they weren't able to access before. So I kind of feel like we shouldn't discount the power for AI art to kind of use somebody's knowledge base and help them generate a worldview that perhaps we haven't seen, that they wouldn't have been able to achieve traditionally.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, with the intent comment was more like, without the human behind it, it's probably just like a random intent that's trained on one of those billions images, and you just get like a random version, like a random thing from this big data set. Not that there isn't any intent originally in those images. I'm just thinking, if we really use it as a tool and there's someone really steering this AI towards like this intent or like this idea, then I think it's definitely extremely helpful. But just like randomizing things and just looking at things that you like, it might not be it doesn't really create this art that that you're used to when you do from scratch.
I guess what it's doing is it's letting
your idea.
Yeah, it's sort of letting people, you know, like traditionally artists will always be inspired by other art and will always, you know, reference or have that, you know, it's very hard as a director to go on set and not be thinking about those things that influenced you to you know, want to make this thing and then try to find your own space within it. I guess what AI art is allowing to happen is people with no artistic integrity who, you know, to simply replicate imagery that they are seeing. And it's kind of like Simon's point to some degree. I think you'll start to see the gap between genuine artists who are using AI and just people who are trying to replicate a fad that they've seen online. And that sort of gap between the two will widen, I think, over the next year as more and more people use this.
Yeah, I think Kofi, sorry.
Yeah, I've got a question on YouTube from Ian Naylor. He said, that playing with the prompt here on Midjourney for the first time, he's found that it's refusing to use certain words. And he's just wondering, what do you guys think about the AI protecting the artists from themselves?
So you can tell that user that using Stable Diffusion, he'll be just fine using whatever words he wants to use. Midjourney in particular, being a commercial product that hides its model. So its model is not really public. They've actually implemented Stable Diffusion on top of what they've already got, but their original model was never made public and was probably very much inspired by ArtStation. I'm just going to... you know, wager here.
Okay.
And because they came out as a commercial product right off the bat, not an open source project, not a research project in any way, shape or form, I think they essentially just made a bunch of words, you know, unusable. The reality of it is if you use any of the other models out there, you can put anything you want in the search terms and you'll get some horrible shit. I'm talking from experience here. It works.
Okay. We've just added Davis. Davis is a VFX student. He was watching us. So, he's got some opinions. So, yeah, if you can just tell us, about yourself and where you study and where you study, that'd be great.
My name is Davis. I'm a visual effects student at the Savannah College of Art and Design, and I'm pretty heavy into AI right now. I've played with Midjourney and Stable Diffusion, DALL-E 2, but I really want to push the boundary and go beyond with like 3D ML stuff. So hopefully merging some like deep faking with the diffusion models.
Yeah, deep faking is close to my heart. Actually, I've been playing around with that for quite a while. I've done a bunch of tests. Actually, there might be some on my LinkedIn if you check it out, like where I just made a very basic metahuman version of myself and then deepfaked it with a model of my face. I think deepfake is interesting. It also has very similar kind of concerns when it comes to getting the rights to use somebody's face in a certain way. There are a lot of question marks there. All of the deepfakes I've done have been using my and my friends' faces, so we're in the clear. But the concern there when it comes to deepfake is, yes, like we live in a world right now where you could load up enough movies of a certain actor or actress and make them do whatever you want and create a video of it. The reason I'm not, and that's just me personally, the reason I'm not that worried about the morality of that side of things is that we've had Photoshop since the early 90s, if not late 80s. But and everyone was saying, okay, you can now paste, you know, any Spice Girl's face on any thing, and you know, the entire world is going to collapse because anybody could be put into a bad situation. The reality of it is never happened, because journalism can't just write off a single picture. It also has to have people, witnesses and documents and things to prove that whatever photo you're showing is true. So with deepfake, there is a weird kind of scary future world of like anybody's face could be put in any weird situation, but we've kind of already lived through that in the 90s with Photoshop, and it never really went anywhere.
I think with the deepfake stuff, you know, it's got real commercial value. You know, again, from a producing perspective, you know, for me to get anything greenlit so that I can be in a position to hire VFX teams, you have to cast bankable talent, and you would be shocked to find out just how tiny that list is. You know, there are actors that you would be convinced will land you a North American sale so that you can fund your project. And they're worth nothing, you know, and this list is so tiny, and these actors are booked out nearly all the time. So that's why it's so difficult to see independent film getting made. But I think the deepfake stuff with AI is going to allow it, especially when you couple it with real-time rendering and UE5 and stuff, is going to let us exist in a world where I can pay an actor to use their likeness, you know, and they'll have final say, but it's like, okay, I have a different artist in, and we're using artificial intelligence to deepfake their face, to deepfake their voice on, and then they'll have approval of performance. But that essentially will get these films greenlit. So there is a world where actually this deepfaking technology generates more greenlit movies, which means more work for all of us, you know, in theory.
And do AI, does AI sort of, because there's many companies and studios that are sort of using AI to generate information of what's going to be a successful movie, and you know, they've got databases of like, if so and so's in this film with cast with somebody else, then there's a 75% chance that we're going to make a lot of money, just because AI has learned what is a successful trailer or, you know, a successful, yeah, you know, type of movie, and let's just generate those type of movies, I guess. Where's that,
yeah,
that side of,
look, you know, where the really scary thing is going to happen, Jamie, is, you know, a year or two from now, when all of these models are able to generate, you know, okay, this is a pretty good temp score, okay, this is a pretty good you know, animated version of the film, you know, I think we're going to end up with, where if you think about what a script really is, it is the most detailed text prompt that you could feed an AI on a project, you know. And so we're looking at a future where you're going, okay, we have a script. We're deciding whether we're going to spend $2.5 million on this. Let's give it to the AI, and then we'll watch the AI version of the film. And if it's no good, then we won't give them the money. And I think we are marching like at rapid speed to somebody essentially housing all of this stuff into one big umbrella and offering that as a service to companies like Netflix. I'm saying it out loud, wishing that that's what I was doing, because it feels like there's going to be a ton of money there. But, you know, that's where we're heading with this. And that is going to make actual artistic integrity within movies very difficult when that comes along, because, you know, first impressions on a film is everything.
Fun future for films.
Yeah, it's going to be a real pain. Yeah, and this is it. But, you know, you're going to end up in a situation. Yeah, you're going to end up in a situation where those bigger movies are getting more and more homogenized. And then there is this space for AI powered Unreal Engine real time using, you know, even in virtual production terms, I can foresee very quickly where we're going to be able to generate something in Stable Diffusion, like a virtual production background in 2D, feed it to something like Google's Infinite Nature. And within two clicks of a button, like, okay, now I have a virtual set OBJ I can open up on a VP stage and off we go. And I think that kind of stuff is going to increase the market value of independent productions. But it's still going to make, you know, there has to be somebody gatekeeping, you know, to try to make sure that people like Netflix aren't AI generating whole movies to decide whether their value is in, whether they get funded or not. So I guess that's kind of where my vested interest comes right now, in trying to steer that model in a direction where it's like, yeah, this is just a handy tool that we use to sell the film in the first place without it becoming the point of the movie.
Yeah, so that would be the more detailed, descriptive, you know, writing to generate a trailer or a movie becomes the actual movie.
I think it's going to be a depressing future for script readers when this kind of tech becomes ubiquitous in the next 5 years, let's say, you know, and you know you're not going to get your script greenlit unless you've written it in such a descriptive manner that it will generate a good AI temp film for them when they watch it to decide whether they're going to fund you or not, you know, and then it's going to make script reading like kind of this boring, arduous task where it reads like prompts. So, you know, this isn't just a thing that's going to affect the art world.
It's not already.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but...
it's already terrible.
Yeah, you know, but this is... I guess that's... that's an interesting argument you just said, though, Simon, because in a weird way, it ties back to what Anthony was saying earlier, where, you know, when your background is in art and or VFX, you know, you become very sort of, like, protective of the craft, right? And when your background is a writer like me, you become very protective of the craft of screenwriting. But to a panel of VFX artists, it's like, that's the worst part of my job, is having to read the scripts. It's so boring, right? And so it, you know, I think AI is encroaching on all of those spaces. You know, there's just no way around it. And it's okay, how do we keep some level of integrity in every department and make sure that we're actually using the AI to pay you guys more, not pay you less? That's got to be the key to this.
I think a big key is definitely keeping people aware of what's happening. Because the thing is it's really easy for a 14, 15-year-old right now who's just getting into, you know, discovering what they like in terms of entertainment, to just, you know, potentially fall in a vortex of self-replicating AI stuff that really didn't come out of a person. It just came out of enough social media retweets, enough, you know, AIs taking that in and then generating more. And then it's really easy for us as humans to just dig ourselves into a single thing because it's comfortable and that's what we like. And that's why, you know, some people might just like, Marvel type entertainment, and then you try to show them an old French movie and they'll just immediately recoil without even watching the movie. They'll recoil immediately. They're like, I'm not gonna like that. I know I'm not gonna like that because I've spent most of my life liking this. And the main thing with AI is that it's going to accelerate the generation of that stuff. So, you know, at the moment, you know, I know some people who love scrolling comics, these comics that are designed for phones. And they're like, you know, funny, whatever, like just, and they have a particular style. They always have a style that looks like that phone comic. Once that is probably the very first point of attack when it comes to AI, because it can
There are some awesome AI comics out there already. There's some AI comic books out there that are great.
Already?
Yeah, they're out there. I mean, I think I've read like 25 this year that I was like, okay, that's actually pretty good. I think the thing that we've got to, I think that conversations like this are super important. And I think that, you know, educating, you know, people who are aspiring to work in the arts, whether that is as concept artists or VFX or as film directors, like really educating them on the power of using artificial intelligence to get their vision across is important. Because if we don't, like, you know, the thing that worries me about AI is that 15-year-old that you mentioned who gets stuck in their own echo chamber, where they make one image with one prompt and that blows their mind. And now they only work on variants of that prompt. And so they never discover their artistic style that they would have discovered through trial and error, you know? And that's the thing I think that you can avoid as long as we're educating on this is how you use AI to express yourself as opposed to get trapped within that art station echo chamber that, you know, that I think is the thing we're all concerned about, you know?
Yeah,
sure.
As Anthony, as a lecturer with concept art and stuff, have you found, like, similar to what Tom's just says, interestingly, have you found any students kind of like, you know, using Midjourney to generate an image that then sparks inspiration to go, okay, I've combined Blade Runner with Mad Max, and then now I'm thinking, I've got an idea that's kind of amazing. I'm going to go off and do something for myself, not get stuck in that, to use it as, you know, prompt words to inspire themselves to then generate something manually.
Oh, definitely, I'm supervising a final year student's project at the moment, and his reference board that he's created for himself contains photography, film stills that he wants to get, and but also some Midjourney prompts of some landscapes that he wants to get. So they're using it. And I think that if we can somehow completely divorce the ethics of how these things work away from that, and we just only talk about the practicalities of how useful it is, then yeah, totally. I mean, it works like one of the techniques we would used to do, would get lots and lots of different photos, a little bit like I suppose the AI would do, and collage them together and put all the crazy blending modes on Photoshop, and then do a little sort of window that you can look through. Very much, you know, when you look at the clouds and you see castles in clouds and things like that. So they're using Midjourney in that kind of way. And I can see how it's really useful in that way, to use it right at the beginning to do that initial total blue sky kind of thinking. But I think then they come unstuck on as artists, and so not as directors, not as screenwriters or producers, as actual visual artists, is then how do they progress from that point? Once they've got that idea, what do they do? Do they then use that as if they just created reference and then they just traditionally do their art as usual? Or do they continue to try and manipulate and fine tune their prompts to get them what they want? But it's so new. It's so new that this is the first year that this has even slightly become something that students deal with. And I know that there are students using it in different ways. That one student is very much, she's very excited about it, and she wants to make it the focus of her entire final year kind of project. And I'm interested to see what she does, but she's also very paranoid about it. She's also worried that will people judge her for doing it this kind of way. And I try and tell my students that, I mean, you're a student, so you're not doing any commercial work, so don't worry about that. It's not like you're making money off of this, so you don't have to worry about that. Use it as an excuse to research it. You know, you're in academia. You might as well fulfill that kind of, that part of that task of being at university and research it and see kind of how it works.
I think as humans, when we care about the art that we're looking at, whether it's writing or photography the people who care about the art intrinsically, they care about the effort sometimes more than they do care about what they're looking at.
Oh yeah. And I think that's a whole thing, isn't it? The process as an artist even if you're a commercial artist, even if you're doing stuff, a concept artist is, they're not like an artist with a capital A. They're not hanging stuff up in galleries. It is like it's part of the pipeline of production. Mm. But there's still, the process of it is a big part of it. It's a pleasure in it. There's a,
and I think you get an appreciation, like a dopamine when you get positive feedback. It's like I've took me 10 attempts at creating this piece or this animation, and the director's like blown away by it.
Yeah,
and it kind of gives you that boost of kind of, whoa, that feels really good.
And I think that there's I think that if you're not an artist and you see someone who's really good at art, they're a little bit like a little magical creature, and you don't really know how they do it, but you're impressed. It's almost like a trick. It's almost like, were they born with talent, or how hard did they have to work to kind of get this? And you, even if you're a director, even if you're a producer, like you said, you know, you can tell a good bit of art that's had a lot of work put into it, and that can't help but impress you. And I think then, but I think there's also a certain amount of envy that goes on. You know, when you see a magician do a trick and they're like showing off, that you, what's the trick? I want to know how it's done. And now AI will allow people to, who don't go through that process, who don't go through the years of hard work and boring practice of having to draw the same fundamental things to get good at it. Now they can kind of do it. They can do the trick as well. And I think it's inevitable. It was always going to happen, but the way technology was going. And I find it fascinating to think about, but I think you've got to remember we're dealing with humans. You know, it's like it's a bit like it's a tool, and I think in VFX it's a great tool, brilliant for doing all these things we've talked about in Nuke and Houdini and Blender. But as an artist, it's like they were working in the car factory, and initially Photoshop was a brand new type of spanner that just did the car manufacturing better. So fair enough, you adapt with that. Then 3D comes along, and now we've got another type of even better spanner that you can use. But now AI comes along, and it's not a spanner anymore. It's one of those robots. And now the robot's making the car. And you're really good at using the spanner, but you know, no matter how quick and brilliant you are with those spanners, maybe you've got to learn how to control the robot. But you don't need as many people to control the robot as you do when it's just the people. And, you know, and I don't want to be accused of, oh, I'm against progress or anything like that. But, you know, it's going to have an impact. It is going to have an impact on people.
Carlo, that's a pretty good segue into B2B, which is, you know, a lot of what you work on and a lot of what you work with. And when you mentioned B2B, and it might not be the right thought to have at that point, but I did think of companies that sell stock images. Let's not mention any names, but you know, stock companies. And when Midjourney first popped up, I have to admit that I immediately thought, if I had shares in a stock image company right now, I'd probably pull them. because that's kind of their business model, is to get artists work, like things that took a long time to make, and then put them up for sale to a wider audience instead of just one to a single buyer, to a wide audience, to then make it cheaper but generate more, hopefully more money for the artist that puts it out there. With AI requiring very little effort, it could either play into their hands where they actually decide to lawyer up and essentially just take over some of the market by creating custom models that nobody has access to based on their own internal database, taking everybody else who's used that database to make a model to court to make sure that they're not using anything that was on their stock website, and then condense their power into that. It condense their power more, or you know, if they don't catch up, it could all unravel before them, and essentially people will just use a service that can generate stock images, and all of these stock companies will just be kind of left out in the cold. Does that ring true to you, or is there
any... I would argue that... Well,
I think from my point of view, if you're working for a big company and they've got their budgets, they always want to have something for as cheap as they can and as quick as they can. So if they can come to someone and say, because a lot of the time I have to sort of visualize an abstract, an abstract idea. It's not necessarily a product. It's something that they, as a company, the idea of the company, and they want to sort of visually express that. So they might come to me for a bespoke set of images for a website or something. And I can see that maybe AI would, someone in their marketing department, instead of writing an email to me with the brief, they could just write that into an AI, generator, and then they'd get what they want necessarily. But I suppose on the flip side of that, going to what Tom was saying about it being a tool, I couldn't do what I do now without the sort of technological advancement of things like Blender and Photoshop, because I can't draw as well. I can't get the ideas out of my head and put them on paper with a pen. And so until digital came along, I couldn't do that. And a lot of people see that as that's not real art, because you're pressing a button, or you're just, using a mouse.
I think everyone on this panel would agree that this is real art. Don't worry.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I know now, but in some of the industries that I've worked in, particularly because I came from a really long sort of journey from shop floor to draftsman to, to digital. So even when I went from, doing drawings on a computer, you'd get the old draftsman coming up and saying, well, you just press a button, it's not, I didn't think there was the same amount of work involved. Yeah. I think that's dropped off on digital art a lot now. People do recognize it as an art, and it is difficult to do. And I suppose with the AI now, it can sort of take it back that way, where you literally are just, pressing a few buttons, but you've still got to have the ideas, haven't you?
Yeah.
You've still got to have that idea to get something out of it.
Yeah.
Which it can't replicate for now, I think.
For now, but it's moving fast.
Yeah.
Kofi, how are we doing for time, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, I mean, happy to conclude soon. So
one thing, because sorry, can I ask you something? You said you think stock footage sites are like in a bad position, but I would argue they are like in a really, really great position, because they have the one thing that the AI needs, like the data set, which sets them apart from everything else. Because I mean, of course, like the scraped data sets are maybe useful for research purposes, but if you have like if it goes into like higher quality images and generating like 4K or 6K or whatever, I would argue that like stock images are like the best way to go without watermarks and all this stuff. So, and I mean, I don't know if you heard that there's like this partnering up from Shutterstock and ImageGen, and they actually, going into, maybe that's something to discuss as well if we still have time. If not, then don't worry. But they actually pay their like certain amount to the people who uploaded the images when it's used for training for different prompts or something like this. I didn't go like completely in depth of it, but I think for me it was interesting to see that there's some reaction to this.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, that was my thoughts exactly. They're either going to lose out or do really well. And if they scramble fast enough to concentrate the power that they currently have, then they'll be fine. But I'm sure a few of them won't be.
Yeah. I was going to say, though,
it is a story of the world.
Yeah, I was going to say, I kind of agree with Justin in the sense that I think that weirdly, the stock sites might be the answer to some of the concerns that Anthony brought up earlier as well. Like, you know, and that you brought up, Simon, like, how do you financially, you know, kind of look after the artist? And the thing with Shutterstock as a company is they already have this giant user base that are paying a monthly subscription fee. So they have like front end users. And they have the actual artists on site too. So, you know, if they only use imagery from their own data set, then exactly that. If you generate an image using their at the front end and they specifically use your picture to train that image, then they have to pay you a royalty fee, similar to Spotify to a musician. And I think that that is kind of the only functioning business model that would look after both the front user and the actual artists that are being replicated.
Yeah, I am probably not knowledgeable enough to know whether or not it's measurable. Like something like Midjourney or, you know, Disco Diffusion, Stable Diffusion, if you type in a couple of prompts, you get a lot of random stuff and sometimes very unexpected stuff. How measurable are those biases that would probably take somebody a lot more knowledgeable than myself about how these models are made? It could be that a company like Shutterstock has to have a type of, but like how they can mechanically actually measure who gets what, like what if you just put like 20 artists' names inside your prompt and looking at that resulting image and like what percentage of that image is for this artist and that artist and that artist, that becomes very complex. I think
it'll end up just being a flat fee for everyone. It'll be like a flat fee where it's like, okay, everybody gets this flat fee, you know, and it won't be as profitable as, you know, like it used to be.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I would have used to have gone to the record store and happily paid $13.99 for 11 songs on an album. Now I get every song ever for 11 quid a month, you know, so it's like, we're going to end up, unfortunately, in the same position where I can think like ArtStation will have their own AI.
I think we all know what he was saying.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Yeah,
go on, Tom.
No, go for it.
Tom, the audio's doing that funny thing again.
No, I don't know. I'll fix it.
I was wondering just like how we have end credits at the end of a movie. Would it be ideal for an image or the data set to include?
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that you mentioned about the Shutterstock and stock images. Well, they get credited. You know, if a publication uses imagery, then you'll often see the stock photo provider credited underneath the photo in a journal or in a newspaper or something like that. And I think it's totally doable for them. If they can scrape billions of images, then I think they know what URLs they're coming from, then I think they can probably figure out some way of credit. And I think credit, even without money, I think credit goes a long way. I think there's something that stings about maybe seeing a bit of your art or something, and it's just not being credited. And I think that the problem is, I don't think the public really cares that much. But I think artists kind of do care. And I don't think that it would be too difficult for them to do that. I just think that, you know, that people are unwilling to credit sometimes because they don't want to sort of dilute their vision. It's my vision. I came up with the prompt and I don't really want necessarily all the credit there. I mean, and taken to the most cartoonish kind of level is I'm going to mention it. He's going to come up at one point. He's going to come up. Elon Musk is that he infamously said that he would never credit any kind of art that he found on Twitter. In fact, artists shouldn't be credited. And obviously that rankles artists an incredible amount. But I think a lot of people say they either agree or they just don't really care. But I think it wouldn't hurt to put the credit on, and I think that I found it puzzling that people don't want to credit people. I suspect I've got my armchair psychiatrist suspicion of why that might be, but I'm not trained enough to say.
I mean, Kofi would agree. Kofi, when we've worked on like a movie and maybe we've done like a week's work of like cover on, I don't know, a big movie, and you don't get credited, it's that type of like, what, how much do you need to work on it to get credited? Because if I've worked on a shot and it's took me a week on like, you know, like a post-office shot or a previous, and it's pretty much that shot when they've shot it, but you didn't work on it for 4 months, so you don't get credited. I guess that's like similar, you know, how much percentage justifies how much credit that person gets, because even like 1 week's worth of work should be recognized. I know the public won't care, but you as an artist, when you're watching it and going, that week was like hard graft, surely it would be cool to just get that recognition and just have a little name.
And at the very least, some, you know, you can cram so much text into metadata, you know, at the very least, you know, it should be required to be in metadata. You know, I know that like social media, they scrape metadata out. So that's not going to work if you're posting on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or whatever. You know, I have my own opinions about all these companies, but the reality is like, if you can't cram an entire massive prompt at the bottom of an image, which sometimes can be a little bit unrealistic, I guess, because they can get really long if you get very convoluted about it. Potentially, you know, at least isolate artist names, you know, so you don't need to credit a house in a prairie with a cow, you know, but at least mention if there's an artist name that's in your database as a recognized artist. Obviously a lot of people have the same names, so that could be problematic as well, but I agree in that, like, Anthony, you make a very good point that, like, you know, Shutterstock will still have a little Shutterstock logo at the bottom of an image of BuzzFeed, you know, on the BuzzFeed front page. You'll still have that little from Shutterstock, or courtesy of. I think if BuzzFeed starts generating most of their images from AI, I think it's fair game to expect them to at least mention the artists that they used in that prompt, if they use any artists. If they just say, I want a, you know, a mouse on a bicycle, then fine, fair game, whatever. But if they go, I want a mouse on a bicycle in the style of a current artist, struggling artist, then they should mention that name.
But do certain artists want to be credited if it's like a, like some other artist doing their work? Because
sorry, actually, you make a very good point. So I have a very good friend whose name I won't mention, but he designed a very famous throne. Let's just leave it at that. He designed a very famous throne in a series that a lot of people have watched. And when, before Midjourney kind of became public, he was getting a lot of Twitter mentions. And it was art that looked inspired by his art, but it always said by his name. And because it was getting added, he would get mentioned, and then he'd just be like, I didn't do that. And he didn't like it. He absolutely hated everything that was being generated. He thought it looked terrible. He was like, I would never paint that. I didn't make that. But everyone on Twitter thinks that I've done that. And he's still very angry about this stuff. And so, yeah, Justin, you make a very good point.
It's not his intention to create this image. So,
in some way,
he's not happy. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. Mm.
All right. So I guess, we can sum it up. And I guess my last question is, can we live with it?
Well, I don't think we've got a choice.
Yeah, we've got, inevitable, I'd say.
Yeah. All right.
Isn't the project a bit too fast for us? I mean, as humans, we've got certain capacity of absorbing stuff. I mean, now it's okay, but in 5 years, probably AI is going to be maybe 10 times as more powerful as today. So,
and will it deflate us as humans to think that, oh, what's the point in learning that? Because next week,
exactly.
I think we all just have to hope that the AI keeps a few of us in a zoo for prosperity and, you know, looks after those that are left.
Yeah.
Maybe they can use it as batteries to power.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. I feel like that's quite a good film, possibly. That could, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's type it up, Tom, and let's pitch that.
I've just told the AI scriptwriter to generate that one.
Are into it.
There we go. Get a buyer.
All right, great. Well, yeah, it's been a great discussion, and yeah, so thank you guys for the time and for sharing your thoughts.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Kofi, for pulling it together.
Yeah, thank you.
It was awesome.
Cheers. Really awesome to chat with you all. Well. Yeah.
Nice to meet you all.
Nice to meet you guys.
Bye, guys.
Good night.
Bye, everyone.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.
See ya. Bye.